Hello and welcome to episode 43 of Exploring Environmental History. I'm Jan Oosthoek. The steppes of Ukraine and Russia were once a sea of grass on rolling plains on which pastoral nomadic peoples grazed their herds of livestock. From the 18th century, the steppes have been transformed into a major agricultural region. This process started after the region was annexed to the Russian Empire and settled by migrants from forested landscapes in central and northern Russia and Ukraine, and also from central Europe. By the 20th century, the former steppe landscape had almost disappeared, save a few remnants protected in nature reserves. On this episode, I talk with David Moon, professor of Russian history at Durham University in the UK, about his recent trip to the Ukrainian steppes as part of a British Arts and Humanities Research Council funded fellowship. In addition to conventional historical research in archives and libraries in Odessa, David travelled through the steppes, visited nature reserves, and met scientists to help him understand how the landscape had been transformed over time. After his return to the northeast of England, I caught up with David and talked about his research of the environmental history of the steppes and his experiences of an environmental historian on a field trip. It is a rainy afternoon here in Gateshead, and I'm joined here by Professor David Moon from Durham University, and he's a professor in modern history, a Russian historian, and he just came back from a research trip to Ukraine, and I've read his travelogue, which was extremely interesting to read because it gave an insight into the workings of an environmental historian and how an environmental historian is going about looking at a region that he's not familiar with in order to write the environmental history of the particular region. And in this case, we're talking about the steppes of Ukraine. Often historians travel to archives where sources of their research topic are located. That's quite normal practice. So reading your travelogue of your recent trip, it seemed to me that it was more like a field notebook of a geographer than a historian. Why is it so important for your research to immerse yourself in the environment, the culture, and the people?
Thanks, Jan. I also spent a lot of time working in archives, reading documents, reading printed sources, reading more recent accounts by historians, geographers, natural scientists. But one thing I've found, I think especially studying an environment that's so different from my own here in the northeast of England, is that I need to have personal experience of being in that environment. Obviously decades, centuries after the time I'm studying, but I can still have a better sense of understanding the sources that I read if I have experience of the environment. And I'd like to give a couple of examples. A very important source for my research is scientific expeditions that travelled across the steppe region and beyond in the Russian Empire in the 1760s and 1770s. And the accounts of these scientists read rather like travelogues, and this is part of what I modelled my text on. And I've had the opportunity to retrace some of their footsteps. So when I read their accounts, I've either before I read them or subsequently have been to the same places, although 2.5 centuries, almost 2.5 centuries later. One example which really struck me, one of the German scientists described being on the coast of the Sea of Azov. This is just to the east of Ukraine in Russia. And he described seeing one of the spits of land coming out from the coast into the sea. And he named it, but the one he named was much, much further west, which is impossible to see. But I'd been to the same place and I'd made the same mistake. And I realised that the reason why it's difficult to judge is because both of us were looking across flat landscape and also sea, and we had no points of reference. And what we didn't have was something, we all have a rough idea of how big it is, there were no trees. And we got a false sense of perspective, it was much further away. So that gave me a real sense of appreciating being in this vast, flat landscape. The second example, again, something I'd read about a great deal in primary sources, a great deal in secondary literature, is that this is a region which is prone to drought, and droughts recur every 3 years with almost tiresome repetition. And as this became largely an agricultural region, This became the main problem facing the farmers and the authorities governing the region, how to deal with the problems of droughts. You can read about droughts. You can read about how no rain fell between April and June. But until you've actually spent time in an area where it doesn't rain throughout the entire spring, I don't think you can fully appreciate what that means. And I had the, I was going to say good fortune, although I think better, misfortune to be in southern Russia in 2003 when there was such a drought. And towards the end of the drought, I remember walking through a field of crops with an agronomist who was in the Krasnodar region of the North Caucasus, which is very, very fertile. And the agronomist was almost in tears over the withered crops in the field. And so that gave me a real perspective that I simply could not have got from reading about the region, about the environment, about the people, about the culture in written texts.
You gave already two characteristics of the steppe landscape of Ukraine. It's very flat and it's very dry. Can you describe what other features the steppe landscape of Ukraine has?
The steppe region extends across Ukraine into Russia, so I'm drawing on my experiences of both, even though I've recently returned from the trip to Ukraine. One important feature, when I first went there, it just seemed flat, and over the years I've come to appreciate that there are different sorts of flatness. And also accounts of these scientific expeditions from the late 18th century, the scientists who wrote those, they also came to appreciate different sorts of flatness. In the northern part of the region, it's an undulating landscape. It's very dramatic, disorientating, with real big skies. But in parts, including where I've just been in Ukraine, including other parts I've been to in southeastern Russia, it's almost completely flat. And this is disorientating in another way, because it's like being in a two-dimensional landscape, which is largely is what it is. The most striking feature of the steppe landscape are the gullies and ravines that cut through it, which have eroded through the soil. And in trying to think about this, it's a bit like the opposite of being in a mountainous landscape. If you're in a mountainous landscape along the bottom, you're looking up at the mountains. If you're in this sort of environment, cut through by gullies, you're looking down into the gullies and the ravines. So it's like a mountainous landscape in reverse. One of the most striking features of the region, I mentioned this before, is the lack of trees. There are trees in river valleys, in gullies, in ravines. There are trees where people have planted them, but it's largely a grassland environment. And the lack of trees is what people going from northern Europe, northern Russia, normally comment on. And then they say, oh, there was a sea of grass.
You mentioned already an agronomist that you met on one of your travels. I found the descriptions of scientists you met in Ukraine quite amusing. You wrote that you experienced that language was not the real communication problem, but that disciplinary boundaries were, in actual fact. So what were the difficulties you experienced and how were these overcome while talking to these scientists?
I should start by saying I'm always very grateful for the time that scientists and other people are prepared to spend talking to me. Sometimes they're slightly hesitant about meeting a historian, and sometimes a conversation doesn't get much beyond that because they feel that they can't explain the details of their research, maybe because I won't have the necessary scientific understanding. Other times we can have a general discussion, I can talk to them generally about their research. And with other people, perhaps those that have more time, for example, a graduate student who was assigned to show me a protected area of unploughed steppe in my recent trip, where we had time for a longer discussion, we could talk about our different disciplinary approaches, what I was interested in, get a sense of understanding her work and the research the team she was involved in was conducting. What I do is I explain what it is I do. I normally begin by explaining that environmental history is a little bit like in the Russian-Ukrainian disciplinary culture of historical geography, because environmental history is just starting to develop in academic circles in that part of the world. I also explain that I don't have a degree in Russian language and literature and apologise for my slightly hesitant Russian. And then I explain what I am interested in. I'm interested in getting a general understanding of their research into the environment, their work on say, different approaches to managing the landscape, how they read the landscape. One thing I learned early on a much earlier field trip, was how you can get an indication of the soil type from the plants, from the vegetation, and under close instruction, in a very basic level, I can start to do that myself. And also learning about the methodologies, so learning about what botanists do when they go out into the field, learning what soil scientists do when they go out into the field and collect their soil samples for analysis back in the laboratory. And this then helps me get a deeper understanding of how scientists have studied this landscape over time.
Talking about scientists looking at the steps, you realize that actually they're looking at these steps because they want to make it more productive in many cases. So you give an impression of the steps as an old agricultural landscape in your travelogue. Can you tell us a little more about the historical development of this region in terms of agriculture and landscape change?
What we might describe as European-style agriculture developed in the steppe region largely from the end of the latter part of the 18th century and the 19th century. For several millennia before that, most of the steppes had been the domain of pastoral nomadic peoples, perhaps most famously the Mongols, who conquered most of the steppe region in the 13th century, and their state and successor states ruled it down into the 16th, 17th and 18th centuries. So pastoral nomadism, large herds of cattle, sheep, goats, camels, further east, horses, was the main form of land use by humans across the region. This does not mean there was no agriculture. They did sow crops in some areas, but largely they traded the products of their economy with farming peoples further north, further west. When European settlers from Russia, also from Germany, elsewhere in Europe, moved onto the steppes from the 18th century, in the early period of settlement, the largest part of their economies was livestock raising. In the region that I've just visited in southern Ukraine, in the early 19th century, sheep farming was the main form of land use, and sheep farming continued to be of importance throughout the 19th century. And a landowner I'll be referring to later, his family made their fortune by rearing high-quality sheep and exporting the wool through the Black Sea to Western Europe. Over the 19th century, growing cereal crops took off. This was encouraged by the development of both railways inside the Russian Empire to move the grain to the ports and the development of shipping to export it via the Black Sea, the Mediterranean Sea. Industrialization in Western Europe creating a large market, and the steppes became the breadbasket of a large part of, in particular, Southern Europe. The grain that they grew, an important grain, was a durum wheat, which is used to make pasta, so that was exported throughout the region. They lost out in the British market to American grain in the second half of the 19th century. Over time, they've diversified, and there's now a lot of sunflowers, a lot of maize, other drought-resistant grains. There were vines in some areas I saw, but it's still largely grain farming. The Ukrainian flag is horizontal bands of yellow and blue, and one version of the origins of the flag is this is a field of wheat under the blue sky.
So it's very much a changed landscape from grass steppe to, well, a sea of crops. I can imagine that during the Soviet period that the scale of everything increased significantly. And you're describing in your travelogue what you phrase as Khrushchev's ill-fated experiment. Can you explain what the ill-fated experiment was?
Before talking about Khrushchev's ill-fated experiment, from the end of the 1920s, there was the region farming was transformed into large-scale collective and state farms. This was a large-scale agriculture on the American model, although the large scale was happening around the same time. This was mechanized agriculture, so they were importing tractors from America, building American model tractors in Soviet factories. So an industrialized landscape. In the 1950s, Khrushchev wanted to take this further, and he launched his ill-fated Virgin Lands campaign. This involved plowing up previously unploughed steppe and long fallow land in the south and east of the steppe region, including parts of Ukraine where I've just visited, not taking full account of the fact that the average annual rainfall was under 400 millimetres a year and in some of the areas under 300, and they didn't take necessary precautions, crop rotations, contour ploughing. This is an area of high winds, and as droughts came round, this led to dust bowl conditions, and large areas of land had been permanently taken out of cultivation or returned to pasture. Most of the virgin lands were further east of where I've just been in southern Ukraine.
I suppose you can describe the region as semi-arid, as you mentioned before, the droughts. This means that it's not particularly suited for forestry. Nevertheless, I understand that forestry plantations were created there. How were they created in a landscape that's not very, very well suited for forestry? And how are these forests doing today?
If I can add an early question, why did they do this? And they did this because the migrants came from central northern Russia, central northern Europe, where they were used to using wood for most things, from construction to firewood. So they planted trees because they needed them. There were also beliefs that if you planted forests, it would change the climate, make it wetter, make it more moderate. A little more practically, if you plant belts of trees and shelter belts, it will protect fields from the drying influence of the wind, also providing shelter from the hot sun and winds in your villages. Trees were planted to protect against soil erosion. So why? A number of reasons for doing this. How? At the beginning, they thought it'd be quite easy, plant some trees and the trees will grow. It turned out to be far, far more complicated than that. And it took decades for them to work out techniques to grow trees on the steppe and also to understand why it was so difficult. One of the reasons is because of the low rainfall, the subsoil is alkaline and few species of trees can survive in this, because once the roots get down into the alkaline subsoil, the trees die. One approach is to find types of trees that will grow in this environment. They drew on native trees, such as willows, poplar, elm. They imported trees, such as plane trees. And the main tree that they've planted is known in America as black locust. In Russian, it's called the white acacia tree. And these can grow with some success. The native species that grows best in the black earth is the oak tree, and I've seen oak trees 500 years old elsewhere in the steppe region. So there are trees that will grow, and there are trees that will even thrive, but you have to plant the right species. You have to work out techniques to cultivate them and to grow them. They need to be protected from the wind when they're saplings. Some trees, oak, you can simply sow the acorns and they will grow in place. Others, they have to grow them in nurseries, protect them and then plant them on. You need to shelter them. Farmers in the region tried all sorts of techniques. Some of the German farmers simply ploughed very deeply, removed the alkaline soil and replaced it, and then tended each tree individually. This is extraordinarily time-consuming and simply was impossible to develop on a large scale. The large plantations I saw were on the left bank of the estuary of the River Dnieper, opposite the city of Kherson, and this is an area of sand. So the sand has created a natural aquifer underneath it, and you can plant the trees there and they do grow. Even so, it's still difficult to grow them, but that's a large plantation that they've grown in the region.
So are these plantations that were created doing damage to the landscape? And what is the general opinion about these plantations? Because here in Britain, there has been a lot of opposition against commercial forestry plantations. Is that the same in Ukraine?
One of the most striking opinions I heard, this was a scientist, a botanist from Kherson University I met. He described large-scale planting of trees in the steppe region as ecological genocide. He said they're planting these trees and they're destroying the steppe environment. He said these people that come from the north, and what they do, they plant trees. And so he was involved in the creation of a national park in the sand area I described, and they wanted to protect this environment because it's an important site for certain types of extremely rare plants. So they were struggling to protect that. They'd been aided by the air forces of the Warsaw Pact during the Cold War because this sand area had been used for the Air Force as their practice dropping bombs. And so no one was going to go there to plant any trees. And when we walked around, we certainly didn't go there either. So that's an example of the military contributing to nature protection. For the most part, people plant trees. They want to plant trees because it gives shelter from the sun for their houses. So all over the region, every time I came to a village, it was full of trees, which had been very carefully cared for. Of the plantations themselves, I didn't come across anyone objecting to rigid lines of trees. It's a much larger place than Britain. And although I saw large forestry plantations in the total area of southern Ukraine, they're tiny. Go onto Google Earth, you see hardly any forest. You have to know where it is to find it.
So scale really matters here. So let's move on to the final two issues. And one is, what are the present-day issues that confront agriculture on the steppes? And perhaps, you know, being historians, how does that link up with the historical development?
Present-day issues surround the transition from Soviet-style agriculture to commercial agriculture. I think that's rather a separate topic for perhaps political scientists, economists, sociologists to deal with. There's still a question of private property in land, which is a highly controversial issue because this was abolished in 1917 at the time of the Bolshevik Revolution. And in Ukraine today, it's still possible only to lease land. And this has all sorts of implications. People who worked on the state and collective farms got some land grants when they were broken up after 1991, which also has implications for the organisation of agriculture. There's all sorts of problems in business surrounding corruption, a lack of a business culture, which is really only now starting to develop, money for investment, the environmental problems facing agriculture. The main one is water. The rainfall is low and unreliable with the periodic droughts. Historically, there were various attempts to deal with this. In the 19th century, long into the 19th century, there was a belief that if you planted large areas of forest, it would cause the regional climate to change and would cause more rain. It was almost as if the migrants thought if they made the landscape more like that which they'd come from, it would have a different climate. It's the same argument as the boosters used on the Great Plains in North America. Rain will follow the plough, plough up the land and it will rain. On the steppes, they thought plant trees and it will rain. It proved rather more approach extremely complex, expensive and difficult to plant vast areas of trees. They did plant trees as shelter belts to protect fields from the wind, and that proved to be worthwhile. Another solution, potential solution, the shortage of water is artificial irrigation. There were experiments conducted in this over the second half of the 19th century, and it proved to be extraordinarily expensive and not worthwhile for grain crops. The topography was wrong. The water was in the bottom of deep river valleys, and you had to pump the water from the bottom onto the fields on the high steppe. This is very expensive. There wasn't sufficient water at the times of year when you needed it, and so the irrigation experiments were largely brought to a halt, other than for particular areas on a relatively small scale. Over the 20th century, with new technology for building dams, irrigation has once again come to the fore. I saw the dam at Kakhovka on the River Dnieper, which created a large reservoir, and water from the reservoir is sent by canal further south across the flat region of steppe and then onto the Crimean Peninsula. And I saw the irrigation channels and the results of the irrigation, and they were pumping it in centre pivot irrigation. I saw fields that were reminiscent to ones you'd see in Kansas, Nebraska, throughout the Great Plains of North America. Although if you go on Google Earth, they're all over the Great Plains. You struggle to find them in southern Ukraine because it's a big investment. Another solution, one that goes back again to the 19th century, is dry farming techniques, cultivating the land in ways that conserve scarce moisture. In the 19th century, they tried, if you keep the fallow field clear of crops and cultivate the land regularly to stop the soil absorb but not evaporate water, it's very time consuming, that will assist in maintaining yields. You can plough deeply, but only when at times of the year when it won't cause evaporation. You can select crops that are drought resistant. So a whole series of techniques. Ultimately, what you have to do is be aware that you're going to get big fluctuations in yield. So you have to save up seed, save up funds in bumper years, and then to even out the fluctuations.
We have now arrived at the final question, and it was a surprise to me to learn that there are some nature reserves and protected areas on the steppes, and that the protection goes back to the late 19th century. That is quite early, actually. Can you tell us a little bit more about these early conservation efforts?
One of the places I visited, in fact one of the places I'd long wanted to visit, was the nature reserve of Askania Nova, which is just to the north of the Crimean Peninsula. This was founded by a German landowner called Friedrich Pfalzfein in the late 19th century. He was a descendant of German settlers who moved on to the steppe in the late 18th, early 19th centuries, and they'd made their fortune through sheep farming. He went to Dorpat University in what's today's Estonia, now Tartu University, where he studied natural sciences. And on his share of the estate, it was divided between him and his two brothers, he decided, as well as carrying on agriculture raising sheep, he wanted to turn some of his estate over for scientific purposes. His first venture was collecting grazing animals from all over the world, and today there are still herds of zebra, North American bison, water buffalo, and all sorts of rather surprising livestock, Przewalski's horses, as well as native Saigaki steppe antelopes on a large area of steppe. And some of them are also in a zoo on the estate, or in that today's the nature reserve. From the 1880s, with the ever greater ploughing up of steppe in the region, he realised that from a scientific point of view, it would be worthwhile protecting an area's steppe from being ploughed up. If you plough up the steppe, it destroys the ecosystem and it takes centuries, if ever, to return. So after three attempts, he found an area which was worthwhile protecting, and where the natural vegetation returned. It had been grazing land, and there's an area, the old steppe, 520 hectares, has never been ploughed up. It's the largest area of unploughed steppe in Ukraine. However, he wasn't content just with protecting the native environment. When you walk out, you can walk out of the old steppe protected area, cross the road and go into his forest park. And this is perhaps the most striking thing about the nature reserve, is there's a substantial area of forest park, which you call the Dendra Park. And this goes back to the 1880s. At enormous expense and effort, he bored an artesian well. He built a water tower, or had it built in the style of a German romantic castle. The water is then supplied by gravity through channels to the forest park, and then he planted trees. Dendra Park was specially designed in the style of a German romantic forest. The area was deliberately designed as a very pleasant area, aside from the hot sun of the steppe, the winds, and the landowner Friedrich Pfalzfein had a grotto built there by an artificial lake, and he would sit there in the afternoon having his tea. He entertained his guests there. He had musical performances and concerts in the park. And on the 3 days I spent there, I did find that early evening I would go for a walk in the park, because after a day of exploring the steppe or whatever, talking to scientists, sitting in the library on the nature reserve, it was a pleasant way to spend the last part of the day before going off and having my dinner and going back to my hotel room to write out my field notes, which Jan referred to at the start of the talk. Friedrich Pfalzfein is distinctive in another way. Tsar Nicholas II visited Askania Nova. It had required great fame throughout the Russian Empire and is still well known in Russia and Ukraine today, although perhaps not as well known as it should be elsewhere in the world. Tsar Nicholas II arrived and he saw the parks, or the zoo parks, or the forest park, and was very impressed. And he granted Friedrich Pfalzfein Russian noble status. Normally, Russian noble status was hereditary, or it was granted to people for their services in the military or their services in the civil service, serving the Tsarist state. Friedrich Falzwein is the first person to be ennobled in the Russian Empire for his services to nature conservation. Sadly, the family had to leave after the revolution of 1917 and Friedrich died in exile in Berlin, deeply missing his paradise on the steppes in 1920. His descendants are still alive today. They live in Liechtenstein, and over the last 20 years, some of them have visited Askania Nova and have become involved in promoting the park. Also in 1985, it was granted the status of a UNESCO Biosphere Reserve, and the principles of UNESCO Biosphere Reserves of non-intervention, protection of environments and human activities, of protecting samples of important environments, actually date back to late 19th century Russia, and Falzwein was one of the pioneers, together with the Russian soil scientist and steppe ecologist Vasily Dokuchayev, who did a similar experiment on samples of steppe, which he protected from human intervention for purposes of scientific research. So Russian scientists in the late 19th century, landowners of German descent, were important in establishing certain features of conservation. In contrast to the American national parks, which date back also to this period, these were not areas set aside for purposes of recreation. They were not set aside because they were aesthetically pleasing, although obviously Falzwein's Dendropark was. They were set aside as samples of important ecological areas for purposes of scientific research, and the reason to protect them was so they could compare them with landscapes that had been altered, in particular by farming. The idea was to learn from the native steppe environment to help find ways of making agriculture-growing crops more sustainable in the environment with low unreliable rainfall, few trees, but extremely fertile soil, which is why the people moved there in the first place, to cultivate the fertile soil.
So it was a very utilitarian outlook. And actually we have a lot to thank them for, because some remnant luckily survives until the present day.
Not just some remnants, there's an extensive network of scientific nature reserves still present throughout the former Soviet Union, and I've visited others, and I'm hoping to visit others over the next few years.
Well, we hope to that we will hear more about your future trips to Russia and Ukraine and your work there. David, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks very much, Jan. It's been really interesting talking to you, and thank you for the stimulating questions.
At this point, we have reached the end of our exploration of the environmental history of the steppe region. On the podcast page of the Environmental History Resources website, you can find a map of the steppes of Ukraine and Russia, as well as some photographs and a link to David Moon's webpage describing his research. I hope that you enjoyed today's journey and that you will join me for the next episode of Exploring Environmental History. This is Jan Oosthoek from Newcastle upon Tyne.